Well, good morning, everybody. Happy Easter to you all. It's great to be here together on this really joyful day, really exciting day, Easter Sunday. My name's John. I'm one of the team here, for anyone who doesn't know me, and really, really excited to just think together now about what this day means. So would you turn back up, if you can grab a Bible nearby, to John chapter 20. That's where we're going to be based with what we're looking at now for this next little while. It's page 1089 in the Red Bibles. And if you can see one anywhere nearby, that'd be great, just so you can follow along what we're looking at in it together. So John chapter 20, page 1089. I guess one of the common accusations leveled against Christianity is that there's just no evidence for it. That to believe in God, to believe in the Christian faith, is pretty much on a par with believing in fairy tales. So the philosopher Michael Tooley, he's an atheist, and he once wrote, "If there is no evidence to support the existence of God, then it is reasonable to believe that God does not exist." And to back that up, he goes on and uses a list of examples. Things like fairies, leprechauns, and golden teacups orbiting around Venus. And all of those are obviously in the same category as God. The one that has been brought a little bit more into the mainstream is the flying spaghetti monster. Perhaps some of you have heard of the flying spaghetti monster. It's been popularized by Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion and in a lot of the stuff that he talks about on TV. He says it's just as rational, just as feasible, that a pasta-based entity is behind the universe, this flying spaghetti monster. That's just as rational as the idea that the Christian God is behind the universe. And I guess when you boil all of that stuff down, the implication is that Christianity is something that no sensible, no educated, and no intelligent person can take seriously. I guess you've heard that view. But here's the thing about Christianity, though. Christianity never expects you to believe without evidence. In fact, Christianity goes a lot further than that. It says you should only believe because of the evidence. And that is right at the heart of this book of John, this account of the life of Jesus recorded by a man named John. And he tells us as much right at the end of chapter 20. So have a look and flip over the page at verses 30 and 31, and I'll read them for us. John says, "Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." What is John saying? Essentially, John is saying this. I want you to believe that this man, Jesus, is the Christ. In other words, I want you to believe that this guy, Jesus, is no ordinary man. He's not only a visionary and inspirational teacher. He's not even a towering figure of moral history. He is the Son of God. Yeah, that is what John wants us to believe. But notice that he doesn't want us to believe without evidence. He says, look, this guy Jesus, he did loads of things in the course of his life. He did so much more than I could ever write down. So I've picked a few things out for you. And I've written it down for you in this book as evidence. Or put another way, John is not an idiot. And John doesn't think you're an idiot either. He knows that he's asking you to believe something really, really huge. He's putting out there for you that a man in history, born at a real historical time, in a real historical place, is the Son of God, come to put the world right. Now, as claims go, they don't get bigger than that, do they? You cannot get a claim more huge than that. And so John knows, if you're going to believe that, if I'm going to believe that, we need some really good evidence. You don't just buy into something like that unless there is massive evidence. Well, what is the evidence then? Well, in verse 30, John describes it as the miraculous signs that Jesus did. In other words, he's saying, look, the claim that I'm making to you that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, is based on a series of things that he did in his life that only someone who is the Son of God could possibly have done. And this morning, we're zooming in together on the greatest and final of these signs, and that is the resurrection of Jesus. Now, I guess to the average British person today, the idea of a real, physical, historical resurrection, somebody returning back to life after being dead, is a frankly ludicrous one. It's nonsense. And with good reason. After all, every single person I've ever known to die during my lifetime is still dead. And the same is true of those you know, very sadly. So why on earth should we believe that it was any different with this guy in history, this man called Jesus? Well, I want to have a go at just beginning to address two questions for you this morning. How do we know the resurrection really happened? Because if it didn't, Christianity is pointless and we should go home this minute. And secondly, what does the resurrection mean for us today? That's what we're going to think about. So, how do we know the resurrection really happened? It's pretty common for people today to hold the view that the resurrection is just a myth or a legend that was made up by the church a few centuries after Jesus. So in this view, it says, look, Christianity started off as a pretty simple movement in memory of a great and inspirational guy called Jesus. But then over time, the stories were embellished. And a little bit got added in here, and a little exaggeration was put in there. And then with everything else going on in the world at the time in ancient history, the church decided it really needed to make itself more influential, more powerful. And so they came up with this story of the resurrection. They made this up and they wrote it into circulation to persuade people to start following this guy Jesus and to make the church something. Well, when you start to probe a little bit, that really does not fit the evidence, okay? And I want to show you just four features of this passage as an example of that. First, the story is too counterproductive to be made up. What do I mean? Well, I touched on this a few weeks ago, for those of you who are here when we were looking at 1 Corinthians. In verses 1 and 2 of John chapter 20, John records for us that the first witness of the empty tomb was a woman called Mary. It's Mary that breaks the news to the others in verse 2. And then if you look a bit further on in verse 16, John records that the first witness of Jesus risen from the dead was Mary. And if you read all the other gospel accounts, they're all the same. Some of them mention other women who were there at the time. Now, why is this important? Well, to get why, we need to understand where women featured on the social status ladder back in ancient Jewish culture. There's a guy called William Lane Craig, who is, he's research professor of philosophy at Biola University in California. And here's what he had to say about this women thing, okay? He says, when you understand the role of women in first century Jewish society, what is really extraordinary is that this empty tomb story should feature women as the discoverers of the empty tomb in the first place. Women were on a very low rung of the social ladder in first century Palestine. Rabbinical sayings of the time said things like, let the words of the law be burned rather than delivered to women. And blessed is he whose children are male, but woe to him whose children are female. Shocking, eh? Women's testimony was regarded as so worthless that they weren't even allowed to serve as legal witnesses in a Jewish court of law. In light of this, it is absolutely remarkable that the chief witnesses to the tomb are these women. If the account was made up later as a legend, it would certainly have portrayed significant men as discovering the tomb. The fact that women are the first witnesses to the empty tomb is most plausibly explained by the reality that, like it or not, they simply were the discoverers of the empty tomb. You see what he's saying? He's saying, look, if you're sitting down a couple of centuries later and you want to make this thing up as a legend, only a complete half-wit with a single figure IQ would have written women into the story as the first witnesses. The content is too counterproductive to be made up. Next, the story is too detailed to be made up. Now, I'm sure that all of us, at some time or other in our lives, have read some fiction. Yeah, whether you're a really avid reader or just a really casual one who kind of buys a few novels to read by the pool when you go on holiday. Well, here's the thing with modern fiction. We're really used to authors deliberately writing eyewitness kind of detail into their story. So if you were to pop into W.H. Smith and go to the Richard and Judy book club, stand right in front of you as you go in, and just pick up a few novels at random, you'll find in those novels things like descriptions of the surroundings. You'll read things like so-and-so was wearing a red jumper, or that the rain was running down the window pane, or that this character was tapping her foot idly. But in ancient legends, you just didn't get that kind of stuff. C.S. Lewis was a world-renowned literary expert. He taught as a fellow of Oxford University for 30 years, and then served as professor of medieval and Renaissance English at Cambridge. Here's what he said about the Gospel of John. I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. I know what they are like. I know none of them are like this. Of this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is the reporting of the facts, or else some unknown writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern, novelistic, realistic narrative. Okay, so what's he saying? He's saying, look, for most of history, anything that was a myth or a legend just did not contain any detail that wasn't relevant to the story, unless it was key to the plot of what was going on. But the Gospel of John has got tons of that kind of stuff. So look at verses 3-5. John records, so Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. So Peter and John were running. Massive. But John, the other disciple, runs quicker than Peter and he gets there first. Now, is that really profoundly significant? Do we take some grand spiritual lesson from the fact that John ran a bit quicker? Of course not. But that is precisely the kind of thing you expect to read when it comes to eyewitness memory. Just being there and remembering it. If you flipped over the page in John to chapter 21, the final chapter, you get there an account of Jesus having a fish breakfast with his disciples. And in verse 11, we're told that just before they have this breakfast, they've caught 153 fish. Now, does the number 153 carry some deep symbolic spiritual meaning for us? Of course not. They just counted their catch, just as you would as a professional group of fishermen. And because eating breakfast with a guy who's been dead is kind of unusual, it has stuck in their minds. Eyewitness detail. The story is too detailed to be made up. Next, the empty tomb needs explaining. You know, as you read the first half of the chapter that we're in, chapter 20, you cannot miss the fact that again and again and again, the fact that the tomb is empty is being emphasized. And you know, that much was never ever debated. Even the early opponents of Christianity never ever claimed that the tomb still contained Jesus' body. The question was always, what happened to the body? And it's a really, really good question. You know, the authorities couldn't have taken it. If they had, they would have been only too happy to produce it and correct the disciples' error when they began going around and telling people, Jesus has risen from the dead. Yeah, the authorities hated that message. The Jewish authorities hated it because it was proclaiming Jesus as the Messiah. And the Roman authorities hated it because it proclaimed Jesus as a greater king than Caesar. So, come on, do you not think that with a rather smug and satisfied look on their faces, if they'd have had the body of Jesus, they wouldn't just have paraded it for all to see? End of Christianity. Then there's the idea that the disciples stole it. It's one pretty much no one holds to anymore, just because it's so laughable. Why is it ridiculous? Well, because nearly all of them died agonizing, excruciating deaths for holding to the one single claim that Jesus of Nazareth was risen from the dead. Who does that for a hoax? And then there's the grave robbers idea. Now, it's true that robbing graves was not at all uncommon in Jesus' day. In fact, there's even an inscription that dates back to the middle of the first century that describes an edict that had been issued saying that anyone who meddled with tombs was to be sentenced to death. So it was obviously going on. But here's where the linen strips become a little bit of an issue. John makes quite a thing of these linen strips. So in verse 5, John mentions that he saw them. Then in verse 6, he mentions that Peter saw them. And then he gives us even more detail about all the cloth and the linen in verse 7. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Now, put your brain in gear for a minute. Does that sound like the work of grave robbers? For a start, one of the main reasons someone would rob a grave was for the value of the cloth that was used to wrap a body. If you leave this stuff behind, it's like burgling someone's living room and leaving the massive plasma TV on the wall. You'd have to be an idiot. And even more than the fact that they're left, John is keen that we understand they're folded neatly. Now, I'm no expert in first century grave robbing, I have to admit, but I would suggest that neatness and tidiness were not the two prominent characteristics first century grave robbers were renowned for. And to stop and fold them before you leave, that's like burgling a house and stopping to do some washing up and a little bit of hoovering before you go. Do you see the only plausible explanation for why the grave clothes are still there? Is that they've been set aside neatly as if by someone who no longer had any need for them. Last feature, the birth of the church needs explaining. As it was read for us, did you notice how ready everyone was to assume and believe that Jesus has risen? No? Good, because neither did I. Verse 2, when Mary discovers the empty tomb, what does she say? I knew he could do it. He's alive. No, she says, they have taken the Lord and I do not know where they have put him. In other words, all that is on her mind is, where's the body? Where's the corpse? In verse 9, John tells us that despite the fact that Jesus had told them again and again and again, after 3 days I will rise, even with an empty tomb, the penny still hasn't dropped. And then there's verse 25. By this point, all of the disciples have seen physically that Jesus has risen. All except Thomas. And so in verse 25, the other disciples tell Thomas, we have seen the Lord. And Thomas replies, oh, you're kidding me. I cannot believe I've missed the first appearance. I'm so gutted I wasn't here for it. Not quite. He says, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and the wound in his side, I will not believe. Do you get the point? The possibility of resurrection was not on anyone's radar. No one was expecting a resurrection. And did you also notice the glimpse John gives us of these courageous and brave disciples sitting together, putting the finishing touches to their grand master plan to start a new worldwide religion on the hoax Jesus is alive? Yeah, me neither. You know, these disciples all did a runner at the moment when Jesus was arrested a few days before. And in verse 19, on the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the door locked for fear of the Jews, they're cowering timidly in a locked room. So how on earth do you explain that just a few weeks later, this same cowardly bunch are standing before thousands of people in the heart of Jerusalem? Not even just any ordinary people. They're standing before the same officials who put Jesus to death. And they're proclaiming loudly and passionately, "Let all Israel be assured of this. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ." Ask the question, what brings about a transformation that radical? A legend doesn't, a conspiracy doesn't, a myth doesn't. But I'll tell you what does. A resurrection. The church did not create the resurrection. The resurrection, against all the odds, created the church. It really happened. But what does it mean? Well, it means loads of stuff, but let me show you three really briefly. Firstly, the resurrection means death is dead. You know, we live in a culture that really isn't very good at facing up to and being honest about death, but death is real. The author, Michael Whitmer, has just published a book called The Last Enemy. And in the introduction of this book, he really doesn't mess around. Let me read a bit of it to you. "You are going to die. Take a moment to let that sink in. You are going to die. One morning, the sun will rise, and you won't see it. Birds will greet the dawn, and you won't hear them. Friends and family will gather to celebrate your life. And after you're buried, they'll return to the church for ham and scalloped potatoes." We need to remember he's American at that point. So, I don't know, put quiche and sausage rolls in there for us. "Soon your job and favorite chair and place on the team will be filled by someone else. The rest of the world may pause to remember you. It will give you a moment of silence, especially if you are rich or well known. But then it will carry on, just as it did before you even arrived. Death is going to take us all. It's our last and inescapable enemy. Or it would be if it were not for the resurrection." You know, there's a really, really weird question in this passage put to Mary. It comes once in verse 13 from two angels and once from Jesus in verse 15, although unbeknown to Mary at that point. So Mary is standing outside the tomb and she's crying. And the question is this: "Woman, why are you crying?" If you went up to Cheltenham Cemetery this afternoon and you saw somebody standing by a grave weeping, what would be the most stupid question in all the world? Why are you crying? Someone cries by a grave because they are feeling the gut-wrenching emptiness that death leaves when it robs somebody and tears them away from life. But this time, it's different. Mike Caine put it this way: "This is the only tomb in the history of the universe where tears are out of place." Why? Because for the first time in the history of the human race, death has not won. And death need never win again. Do you see? Jesus is undoing death itself. Back in chapter 11 of John, Jesus had said the words, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies." What did he mean when he said that? He meant, you'll still die, but your death will be like a wasp without a sting. Harmless. And rather than being the end of life, it will really be only the beginning of life. Now, it's really easy to say that. Anyone can say those words. But as Jesus Christ stands there in front of Mary, having taken death on in battle and absolutely smashed it, he's proved the words that he said. And so rather than being the most stupid question in the world by the side of this tomb, it is actually the most fitting and glorious question in all the world. Why are you crying? Death is dead. It's dead. Next, it means, in the words of my favorite Lord of the Rings quote of all, everything sad is going to come untrue. Guys, let's be realistic about life. Death is our worst enemy, but it is by no means our only enemy. I hope you enjoy life, I really do, but however much you enjoy life, you cannot deny that we live in a world with an awful lot of brokenness and an awful lot of pain. We see it on the big stage, famine, bloodshed, war, poverty, terrorism, disease. You open up any single newspaper today, and I guarantee you, it won't take you long to earth all of those words in real stories, tangible places, ordinary lives. And we see it on the stage of our own lives too, don't we? Pain, frustration, disappointment, anxiety, fear, hopelessness, meaninglessness, heartache. And even those rare moments that we have when you just feel so happy and content that you want to stop for a minute and say, this is how life is meant to be. Those moments pass. They slip through your fingers. You can't hold on to them. And you know that however far around the corner it may be, the next sadness or dashed hope is only around the corner. Life is broken. But the moment Jesus stands once again on the face of the earth, life full, not life less, that moment is a promise to our hearts that everything sad is going to come untrue. The New Testament describes the resurrection of Jesus as the first fruits. What does that word mean? Well, let me give you an illustration, not about fruit, but it's one I like because I'm Welsh and daffodils are kind of our national flower, okay? Where I sit and work in my study, I look out onto a flower bed in which we have daffodils. Obviously, I don't look out at them very often because when I'm there, I'm deeply engrossed in my work at all times. But in the rare moments I do look out and see these daffodils, they're lovely. Now, when do daffodils come? They come at the breaking of spring. And when I see those daffodils, I know something for sure. Summer is coming. The year is heading towards summer. Now, sure, there'll still be cold days and windy days and rainy days, as we've seen pretty much this whole last week. But there is no going back. Summer is coming. As Jesus stands outside his own no longer needed tomb, and as he stands there showing his real, physical, tangible body, it is the ultimate breaking of spring. Yes, there will still be cold days, windy days, and wet days in our lives and in the world, but there is no going back. Summer is coming. God has begun to put the world right. God has begun to put life right. And, you know, the resurrection of Jesus guarantees that one day God is going to finish the job. And everything sad will come untrue. And everyone who has believed in this Jesus will begin to experience the eternal sunshine of a world made new. But you know, the resurrection isn't just about the future. It's about a life that starts now. So lastly, it means you can have life as it was meant to be. I began by referring to verses 30 and 31. John tells us the purpose of his whole story about Jesus. And I did that to show you that his book is all about evidence. His book is all about evidence to convince you that Jesus is the Son of God. And the resurrection should do just that for us. But, you know, John only wants us to believe that as a means to an end. It's not like he's sitting there thinking, I really want to persuade you Jesus is the Son of God so I can notch up another intellectual victory. Will you look at verse 31 and see why he wants you to believe? These are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Here at Cambrai, about 18 months or so ago, we began to look together at this Gospel of John. And right at the start of that time, I used an illustration from a book called Real Life Jesus by Mike Kane. And the illustration was all about a bunch of beached whales. You may remember it if you're here. Now, even if you weren't, we all know quite how sorry a sight a beached whale is, right? When you see a beached whale on the news, it looks miserable and it looks pathetic. Because a whale wasn't made for the beach. All a whale can do on a beach is do its best to eke out some kind of flappy existence. And it's one that sure is not going to last. You know, in this book, John is saying to us, we as the human race, you as an individual, me as an individual, are like a bunch of beached whales. We were made for God. God is our ocean. But we've all thought that the beach looked more attractive. We all thought we would be better off doing life without God. We've all thought that even the idea of life with God is just going to be really restrictive and dull and boring. And so we've ended up in a life we were never made for. And we're all doing our best to thrash out and eke out some kind of existence. Be honest for a minute. Have you ever wondered why no human relationship can ever truly give you what you need? Have you ever wondered why no career achievement really and deeply fulfills you? Have you ever wondered why that next purchase or that next pay rise or that next home improvement that you thought would satisfy you still leaves you empty and needing more? Have you ever wondered why, despite whatever you might rationally believe about all this God stuff not being true, it just feels like there is more to life than this? Than just making the best of it, getting old and dying. You feel those things because you are flailing on the beach when you were built to swim in the ocean. But you know what? The resurrection means Jesus is who he said he is. It means he's the Son of God come to take you back to the ocean. Restore you back to the ocean. He's come to take you to swimming freely in the life you were made for. And it's a life that can start today. And it's a life that will one day truly and fully be life as it was meant to be. Death is dead. Everything sad is going to come untrue. You can have life as it was meant to be. You know, Jesus stood in front of Thomas and he said to him, Thomas, stop doubting and believe. Will you? Let's pray. Our Father, on today of all days, we simply want to thank you, above all, that you raised Jesus from the dead. We thank you that him coming to die for us, to pay for our sin, was shown to be something that worked. He pulled it off. It was a success. And we thank you that because of this real, true, physical, historical resurrection, we can know that death is dead. We can know that one day you will finish the job that the resurrection of Jesus begun, of making everything right, of making everything sad come untrue. And we thank you that in Christ, through Jesus, if we will believe the evidence that he is the Son of God, that he offers us the journey back to the ocean, the journey to life, to begin life as it was meant to be, the life we were made for. Oh, Father, please, would you impress that upon us? Whatever else we came here this morning believing, will you open our eyes to see the amazing glory of all this truth, that it might change us forever. In Jesus' name, amen.